From high atop Feibusch Media World Headquarters, back home in Rochester, New York, it is the Top of the Tower podcast. I'm your host, Scott Feibusch. This podcast is brought to you by your friends at Wheatstone, your source for anything and everything studio-related, mixers, consoles, IP networking, mic processing, even furniture. Plus, Wheatstone makes audio processing and the popular Jockbox, the Vox Pro digital audio editor. It was great to see the Wheat team and everyone else at the radio show in Orlando. That's a lot of what we're going to be talking about on this week's edition, including a wrap-up segment with a couple of our smartest friends in the engineering community, Dan Hyatt and Nick Stracke. We'll hear from them in just a minute. First, though, a few bits of more recent breaking news from back home in Northeast Radio Watch land. A lot of talk this week about WPTR, or as it's now known, WDCD in Albany, or as it's now formally known to the FCC, DWDCD. That's how you indicate a deleted radio license. And as of just a couple of days ago, that is what has happened to AM 1540 in Albany. The owner, Don Crawford Jr., DJRA Broadcasting, told the FCC earlier this week that it was going to return the license for cancellation. The end to a very long era of some really good radio in Albany, and then a lot of years of decline, too.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to WPTR, Albany.
Of course, back in its heyday, then WPTR was not just one of the biggest top 40 stations in Albany. It was one of the biggest medium market top 40s really anywhere in the country. Boom Boom Brannigan and all those great jocks who graced its airwaves for many years. But it was always a somewhat troubled AM facility. It was always one of those stations that seemed to succeed in spite of its AM facility and not because of it. Sure, it had 50,000 watts of power. Yeah, it was a great signal over Albany itself, and it was a great signal at night over a huge chunk of New England because that 50,000 watts all blew directly east from the transmitter site. But the problem is that even in its heyday, a good chunk of the Albany-Schenectady radio market was in Schenectady, which was behind the AM pattern and had a hard time hearing the signal, especially at night. And of course, you know, that may have worked when it had this incredibly desirable top 40 programming. After 1980, when that top 40 moved over to its sister FM station, WFLY, where it is still going strong, by the way, to this day, after that, 1540 had struggled. It was country for a while, and then it spent a lot of years doing religion, and then even the religion moved over to FM after a while. And in the end, basically what happened was that it was a signal in search of a reason to exist. And there's not a lot of room for those AM stations like that these days, especially with power bills that were as high as the power bills were and the amount of land that was needed for the three-tower directional array right near a pretty big commercial strip in Albany. So the station had been on the market for quite a few years without any takers at its going price. And so they went to the FCC and said, listen, under special temporary authorization, could we perhaps reduce our power down to 25,000 watts or 10,000 watts and see if this will allow us to reduce our power bill enough to make this radio station economically viable once again, keep our power bills under control? And the FCC said, no, this isn't an appropriate use of the STA process. We expect you to come to us with some technical reason why you can't broadcast, or that a storm had come through, knocked down your tower, something like that. It's not supposed to be an opportunity to just say, can we reduce power and see what happens? Now, of course, those of us who play the FCC game a lot know that there are workarounds from this, that you could go to the FCC, for instance, and just say we're having some unspecified problems with our transmitter that we need to work on resolving. Can you let us run at 10 or 25,000 while we work on fixing them? And, of course, at the same time while you're doing that, you can always be studying economically how this is affecting your bottom line, whether listeners are still able to hear you within the market, and then come back to the FCC after that and say, okay, now we want to file on a more permanent basis to reduce our power, or we want to go back to 50,000. For whatever reason, they didn't do that, and so here we are now at the end of the road for this AM station. There are some other circumstances, too, that play into this. The fact, for instance, that there were other AM stations with translators, which 1540 never applied for, that are also silent at the moment and for sale in Albany at presumably a lower price than 1540 would have gotten, and certainly lower power bills, lower operational costs. So this was in some ways sort of a one-of-a-kind thing with the Albany market being as crowded as it is. But at the same time, it's also, I think, part of a story that we are going to be seeing elsewhere in the country where there are these AM stations that just really cannot find any reason for being anymore. And unfortunately, this probably is not the last of these that we're going to see. So we say farewell to the legend of WPTR and WDCD on AM. Of course, the format is still out there and air checks to enjoy. There are still there's still oldies radio on the air, sort of in Albany at least. WTRY, which was its big competitor, survives sort of as a classic hit station on the FM side, but still really the end of an era in Albany. Moving back to Orlando, we're going to have some thoughts at the end of the podcast today about what we learned in Orlando and about the overall state of the radio industry and in some ways why a situation like 1540 in Albany may have kind of happened. But first, at the end of the show on Thursday afternoon, we had the chance to sit down with a couple of the most interesting guys that that I know right now in radio engineering and have a little conversation and a wrap-up of the show with Dan Hyatt from Denver and Nick Straka from NS Radio Engineering in New Jersey about what they saw and what they were thinking about in Orlando.
We are in the final minutes of the radio show talking with two of my favorite experts on this stuff, Dan Hyatt and Nick Straka. Hey, guys.
Hey, what's shaking?
Hey, Scott, how are you?
All right, what's your takeaway? What are you going home having learned?
Takeaway in this has been a very busy show with a lot of programmers and engineers coming together at this show. You know, I've seen a good balance of both. It's a little bit different than Vegas, which is more geared towards engineering. And this radio show can sometimes tend to weigh towards programming and forgetting about engineering. But this time around, it's been a very good marriage of both. And at the various booths, you've had both sets of people, directors of engineering, you've had programming people coming up and all asking very good questions. So it's been a really well-represented show, which is nice. It's good to see because the radio stations, you got to pull together at this point. It's 2018. We can't just be off in our own little silos. I'm an engineer. I'm a programmer. And not ever talk to each other and have disdain. We have to all come together to make this work.
And Dan, that's part of why you started the Broadcasting Club.
Well, yeah, we want to bring everybody together, and we want engineering to mesh with programming and programming to mesh with engineering, and, hey, we can even have some sales folk and, God forbid, the sales folk.
Promo people
and management all together. And, you know, just to kind of step back on what Nick alluded to a few moments ago is this show was interesting. In years past at the radio show, I did feel like there were different factions of folks. You could definitely see the diversity. You had the programming folks here, a few engineering folks here, and so forth. But now with this show, really everybody came together. And a lot of the questions just running into people and kind of mingling about, I saw a lot of folks, I spoke to a lot of folks who wanted to know more about kind of a do-it-yourself. What can we do as radio begins to virtualize a little bit more? And we're seeing individual podcasts out in different areas where people are having takeaway studios, take-home studios where the engineer isn't necessarily coming to their house to build this huge facility, but they want to have a simple piece of software, whether that's via their telephone or via computer, and a few pieces of hardware from different manufacturers, plug it in themselves. So now we're seeing radio start to evolve into this kind of do-it-yourself, I don't want to say a prosumer because it's all professional, but do-it-yourself, a little bit easier to configure, a lot of remote control access. We saw some cool stuff from Comrex where we're able, with an NX, or rather the Opal system, to send a link out to somebody on their telephone or on a web browser, and all of a sudden they click on that and they've got a two-way connection. So now things are becoming much easier.
And really cleaning up your interviews, like with the Comrex Opal, the days of having somebody on a chintzy little telephone doing an interview are over. Art Bell started that a little bit when he was on Sirius with his Midnight in the Desert show, and it was actually disconcerting to hear at first because you were so used to the guest having that telephone quality, and then all of a sudden the quality is almost on parity with Art, and it was very weird to listen to at first.
It's like when sports started going to FM, and at first I wasn't used to listening to a baseball game that way.
Yeah, and the processing's different. I can say New York, I'm from New York, and listening to a Yankee game on 660 versus 101.9. I still, I guess I'm old school, like to kick it on 660 because you feel the crowd, the processing sucks that crowd noise up. Sometimes on 101.9, it sounds like John Sterling and Susan are just sitting in a room somewhere. You don't get the same feel of the game. I guess we have to come up, Daniel, with some kind of processing preset for, like, game crowd.
Call smash it and expand it.
Yep.
You know, it reminds me of, I was thinking back to kind of the days of maybe the first Gulf War, as a kid. I think I was maybe six years old. But watching the reporters for the first time start to try to utilize some of these technologies. And then a little further, we started to see reporters on TV using Skype, and it was kind of this mumble-jumble thing. But now we've got, like, the Comrex Live Shots and other things like that to where they're using this IP technology, and all of a sudden the quality is better than the satellite has been, and the latency is much lower. So it's interesting to see how technology begins to evolve year after year. And this year I just feel like we've taken a huge leap forward.
Now, speaking of being able to do interesting things with phones, you have a new box.
I do. It's called the Interchange, and everyone asks, what does this thing do? So we let them hang on it a couple days, and today we finally revealed what that is. And really, what
well,
it
hang
is...
hang on. You got to give the full name of it. Oh, the Interchange.
Okay. From the mind of Daniel Hyatt. Or, as somebody suggested, from the minds, plural, with a little parenthesis around it. anyway, what the Interchange is it's a go-between box that allows you to upgrade your facility from the traditional analog lines to SIP lines, and then further offer an audio breakout to your studios, whether that's analog, AES, or you choose one of the AOIP manufacturers, whether it's Wheatnet, Livewire, Dante, Ravenna. There's a whole number of them out there. And our whole idea was, we just want to be able to get the audio in. So it's not my choice what you use. Hey, whatever you prefer to use, that's great. That's your choice. We want you to be able to use that. But we need to get the audio in and out. And until now, there really hasn't been a solution. We've kind of had to home brew a couple of things. So this is really a result of that home brewing. And we continue to roll out SIP systems right and left, whether that's for commercial offices, for broadcasters, or a combination of both, where we're satisfying the front office as well as the production and on-air studios.
And the beauty of the Interchange is it will work with any button panel that you have on your existing console. And also, you can save a lot of money by not having to get specialized handsets just to screen calls. Sometimes you look at it, especially in a smaller or medium market situation, we go, I don't have 4Gs to drop on just telephones for people to say, yeah, hang on, what's your topic? You'll be on the air in 5 minutes. You can leverage your existing system and your SIP system to screen your calls, put everybody on hold, forward into the system. You can call the office number now, and instead of having islands like you used to have with POTS, where you had your POTS lines coming into the studio and your office lines going into the studio, you could not transfer between them. I put in a SIP system at a client station, and oh, the office rings, no big deal. I'll transfer to extension 201, now you're in the on-air system.
You guys are both, you work with a lot of clients who don't have unlimited budgets. And I know, Nick, you in particular have been very vehement in online discussions about the value of going now to an IP infrastructure and not trying to continue to make do with analog. What are you seeing here? What else was at this show that would help make that case to people?
I think if you look at every product, every current product that a manufacturer has at this show, there were no analog-only products at this show anywhere to be found. Everything was some form of audio over IP. People talk about it's an IP console. Well, there's no such thing as an IP console. IP is just the transport mechanism. It's a taxi to get the audio bits from one point to the other point. So to go analog, for example, I have a small client. They're a little NPR station in upstate New York. I say upstate. Scott looks at me like, no, that's not upstate. That's downstate.
It takes me 4 hours of driving south and east to get there. It's downstate.
From New Jersey, it's all upstate. Anything except Long Island and Manhattan is upstate. So they were looking at, well, we have these radio system consoles, and they're great little analog consoles. We just bought them 4 years ago. They're moving into a new facility. I said, well, why can't we keep them? I said, well, it's going to cost about $12,000 in multi-pair wire and conduit. And then it's going to cost even more for me to spend days punching it down. And then to make any type of changes, the IP, AOIP systems are so fluid, you need to make a change. Go in and change a cross point from your computer. Analog, well, I've got to unpunch this. I've got to punch it over here. I have to actually be on site. So by the time I did the installation costs, it's going to be about $35,000 for parts and materials to install the existing consoles. It came out to about $46,000 to put an AOIP system in that's infinitely expandable, and they just looked at it and went, oh, okay, now we know what you're talking about. That makes sense. Why would we do this when we can do this? And the remote access is just wonderful with an AOIP system.
Absolutely. Daniel, at the speed at which you move and the pace at which you build things, you couldn't do that analog.
No, there's no way. You know, we want to make things as flexible as possible. And with AOIP facilities, as I was speaking with a client the other day, okay, do you want to pay the engineer to come in and spend 3 hours moving one wire to another part of the building and pulling that wire, standing on top of a ladder, possibly falling off the ladder, laying in pain and agony, going through the drop ceiling with mouse poo and other things?
It's almost like you've been there.
Well, you know, possibly so. Or can I just turn a knob and hit enter? And, you know, it's funny. I was just in a very old facility several days ago, and they're converting to AOIP. But in the short term, I had to run a couple of wires for a switcher. Well, this building is pre-World War II. So between I and one other person, it took 2 hours to drill through the wall, and then it took 2 hours to pull the cable through, and then finally we terminated. So it took about 5 hours, where if we had AOIP, it would have been one network cable to each location, and it would have been done in a matter of minutes.
All right, so what's happening next with the Broadcasting Club? We had the RV party here the other night out in the parking lot.
I believe it's going to be a team-up between the SMPTE and SBE chapter in Denver for a big celebration in the coming weeks, so stay tuned for that. Both those folks or groups of folks have reached out and wanted to do that. So it's kind of the home base for the Broadcasting chapters right there in Denver. But as we expand, we've got chapters opening up across the country. We've got some membership stuff going on, and we've also got some learning opportunities going on. So there's going to be a lot to come on the Broadcasting Club. Keep your eyes open.
And on the East Coast?
On the East Coast, we're looking to do maybe a little get-together before the AES NAB show in New York. Little dinner, nothing huge, no rager like Las Vegas. And we're also actually starting to plan the Vegas NAB party for the Broadcasting Club. We're really going to pull together something special this year, too.
I'm beginning to think we've started outgrowing hospitality suites.
Yeah, I think we're going to get into stadiums pretty soon.
All right, so what are you guys working on next?
Well, I was thinking about sleeping at some point for a couple of hours. I haven't done that for several years.
You?
Lots going on. We've got the phone stuff is huge right now. Doing a lot of transitioning buildings from traditional lighting to LED lighting. And also working on some really cool projects with luminescent panels, which we can do for promo billboards for radio stations. We can do promo vehicles for radio stations. And imagine this, Scott. You can have your Scott Feibusch vehicle completely ghost decaled, can't see it at all, but as soon as you roll up to that parking garage at NAB in Vegas, you flip the switch, and now it strobes your name.
I feel like we've come full circle to when you were the cheap lighting guy.
Yeah, well, you know, now there's a lot of rebates available, as I think I was a little ahead of the curve there for a while, and now combined with the affordability and the rebates, people can really save a lot of money. And, you know, that's not limited to outside commercial products. Hey, radio stations, you want to save 90% on your electric bill throughout the facility with regard to lighting? Hey, we'll go on there and we'll swap that thing out. We'll save you a ton of money there. It's all about the savings.
Actually, you want to save more than 90% on just your electric bill. You're going to save on your HVAC load. If you pull incandescent or halogen lights and track lights out of your studios and put in LEDs, you're reducing your heat load by quite a bit. I did in my own house, and I noticed a huge difference with the AC.
So what else do you have going on, Nick?
Well, when I get back, I have to address one of my sites had an expansion tank that was 3 floors above break and pour some water through my transmitter site. Luckily, I got it back on with the aux transmitter remotely, again with IP systems. The beauty of this is I was able to reroute everything and get a signal back on the air at full power. I'll look at it next week, and then beyond that, some studio construction projects and some big things happening.
We'll be talking to you guys again. Thanks.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks, Scott.
Always good to hear from Dan and Nick about what they're thinking about. You can always find out more about the Broadcasting Club at the Broadcasting Club Facebook group. Of course, a few of my own thoughts about the show, and I expressed some of this at the beginning of Northeast Radio Watch this week, perhaps not totally coherently because I was writing in a hotel room at about 1 in the morning after several days of very little sleep, catching up on everything at the show. It's an interesting group of people who attend this show. It is not a huge show. It was a little over 2,000 people who showed up this year in Orlando. It was even smaller than that last year when we all got together in Austin. But it's a group of people who, first of all, tend to be very, very passionate about radio, who are very engaged in the industry. It's a good opportunity if you want to really get a good chance to talk with vendors on a relatively quiet show floor. It's much more relaxed than the big show in Vegas, for instance, is. you get more of a chance to really chat with vendors about what it is that they're developing and give them some ideas. We saw some neat products on the floor, including a neat rack-mounted set of AM, FM, or weather radio tuners, responding to one need that a lot of us who deal with EAS gear have had in the industry. And that came directly out of a conversation, actually, that had been on the floor, I believe, in Vegas. And lo and behold, there's a product that's out there now in Orlando that'll be on the market. You'll be hearing more about that, hopefully, in the Radio Insight Tech section that's brand new and a couple other places in the days and weeks to come. But getting back to sort of the other pieces of the show, the programming piece and the business piece, is that the radio industry is still trying to figure out how to respond to all of the changes that have happened around it. In a lot of ways, I think a lot of us are still kind of stuck back in that WPTR Top 40 AM era that a lot of us have a hard time letting go of. And it is indeed sad to look east to Albany and to know that 1540 is not going to be on the air there anymore. But at the same time, I think a lot of us have to realize, okay, here is where we are now as a business. We are one source of audio content amidst a huge sea of content now for people to consume. We had the deal that was announced just before the show started, the SiriusXM Pandora deal, where, you know, that was nothing to do directly with broadcasting, but everything to do with audio content, because those are some of the sources that our listeners are going to now to try to find what they're looking for. So where are we in all of this? Well, one of the sessions that I sat in on in Orlando was all about emergency preparedness. And we heard from people who had been through the fires in Sonoma, who had been through shootings and tragedies in their towns and had tried to figure out how their radio stations could help deal with it. And that's one of the big values that we still have as radio. We still have the ability, if we want to use it, to be there right away with live content. That's a lot harder for a lot of these other media to do still. We are still able to put a signal up on one transmitter and instantly reach everybody in a market at once if they choose to tune in. And that got me to thinking as I was driving around Orlando about the first time that I ever went to Orlando. I still have pictures in a scrapbook here that I took out the car window when I was maybe 13 years old, driving from the airport out to Disney World in the mid-1980s. And what was I taking pictures of out the car window? I was taking pictures of radio station billboards. And I still have pictures that show WKIS, News Radio 740, and WDIZ FM 100, and BJ 105, the big radio stations in Orlando. Those billboards mattered in part because it meant that I could immediately reach down and know exactly, being brand new to this city, what the big stations were and what the voices were that I should be listening for here. Fast forward 30-some years to 2018, driving around Orlando, you don't see broadcast at all. And it's not just Orlando. I flew into Atlanta with Lance Venta from Radio Insight. We took a long road trip down through middle Georgia and down through North Florida. Had a great visit to the University of Florida, which I'll be talking about a little bit later on the podcast, about what they're doing and how they're training their students, which is just fantastic there. And then down to Orlando, over to Tampa, back up the coast from Daytona all the way up to Savannah, and then back to Atlanta. You know how much radio promotion I saw that whole trip? Almost none. There was almost none of it out there. There was nothing out there telling people, hey, you're in Jacksonville. The Big Ape is still on 95.1. You ought to be listening to this. There was nothing telling people, hey, welcome to Savannah for news and talk. Tune in to 97.7 and 1290 WTKS. It wasn't there. We are not telling people in this industry where they can find us. And we're assuming, I think, that they still know. And you know what? We're not one of 5 or 10 voices on the radio anymore. We're one of thousands or even millions out there. So if there's one message that I kind of took away tangentially from all of this, it's that we have to do a better job of letting people know we exist as radio and giving people a reason to want to tune in and find out what we're doing. And if we do, then we can start reversing some of these trends that that came out in some of the research that was shared at the show about the declining number of people who are even tuning in radio in the car, which is supposed to be the last bastion of radio listenership, never mind the declining number of people who bother to try to find a way to hear us at home or to make us one of the selections that they want to choose if they're using a smart speaker or if they're using their phone. We can still reach them. There are times where we still absolutely need to be reaching them, but you know what? They're not going to find us in emergencies either if we don't already have them establish the habit of tuning into us and knowing where to find us in the first place. So promotion, that's one of the big key takeaways that I took kind of tangentially, even if it wasn't directly from a session on the floor, that if we don't let them know we're here, they're not going to find us anymore. So just one thing to think about from the radio show. We will still have more coming from the radio show. Did a whole bunch more interviews that you'll be hearing next week on the Top of the Tower podcast. We'll have the outcome of the big EAS test that is just moments away as I'm recording this. In fact, I'm glad my phone hasn't gone off quite yet as I am recording this on Wednesday afternoon. But a lot more from the radio show. Interested in hearing your thoughts, too, if you were there or even if you weren't there. And about shows in general, whether there are ways that the radio industry can come closer to you as a radio person and make it easier for you to get some of the information that we were able to bring home from the show. That does it for this edition of the Top of the Tower podcast. Again, always happy to hear from you by email at scott@fivebush.com, on Facebook, at the Northeast Radio Watch Facebook page, or wherever you want to find me. This podcast, again, brought to you by your friends at Wheatstone, your source for anything and everything studio-related, mixers, consoles, IP networking, mic processing, even furniture. And Wheatstone makes audio processing and the popular Jockbox, the Vox Pro digital audio editor. Again, it was good to see them in Orlando. Orlando was also the debut in print of the Tower Site Calendar 2019. That is available for you right now and shipping this coming week from the Fivebush.com store at Fivebush.com. That's the Top of the Tower podcast. See you next week. Bye.